This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, we'll bring you the latest from Brussels, where EU leaders have been burning the midnight oil in search of a solution to the continent's debt troubles. We'll find out about the mood on the streets of Tunisia after the country's first free elections, and we'll bring you this story from Poland.
After the war, nobody talked about it. If you asked anyone in the region, they immediately changed the subject and, quite frankly, although there has been a film about it and now a new book, it still touches a raw nerve.
You want to know what it is? Well, stay tuned. We'll let you know that and much, much more coming up on Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio. Let's get started. European leaders were staying up late in Brussels on Wednesday, working long into the night and into Thursday morning, in fact, on a deal that would shore up the Eurozone. There were three main issues at hand. First, the EFSF Rescue Fund, which looks likely to be boosted to 1 trillion euros. Second, a plan to recapitalize ailing banks, which was largely put in place as well. The third point is proving to be a bit stickier. Banks have been holding out on a deal to take a haircut, perhaps as much as a 50% haircut on Greek debt. I asked our correspondent in Brussels, Vanessa Mock, why is that?
Well, it's a very difficult negotiation with the banks, which is why we're seeing these hours of standoffs. Basically, the banks cannot accept a deal whereby they would voluntarily, which is what they're being asked to do, voluntarily accept losses on the Greek debt that they hold. We were talking about tens of billions of euros, and then go back to their customers, their boards, and say, yes, we did that for free, just to do the EU governments a favour. And don't forget that when we talk about private bondholders, we're not just talking about banks, we're also talking, for instance, about pension funds. It's very, very difficult for the pension funds to also agree to such enormous losses. But the problem is that if that is not agreed voluntarily, well, then what happens next? And that's now the big nub of the issue, because the concern is if you can't get the banks on board, then maybe you have to force a Greek default, i.e. you have to force those holders of that debt to accept losses with unforeseen, unpredictable consequences on global finance markets.
Yeah, speaking of those financial markets, there is already talk that even though the bailout fund has been more than doubled or will be more than doubled in value, that this is just a deal that they're going to have to revisit in not very much time.
That's right. And in fact, unfortunately, that's how it has been throughout this Eurozone drama, that they've said time and time again, yes, we've really nailed it this time. And then actually the nail has come loose, as many of my fellow journalists here at the summit have been pointing out all evening. We've already been here six times just in 2011, not to count all the amount of high-level crisis meetings that were held last year. And the concern is that right now, that instead of having this big, broad, comprehensive plan of action, all you're doing is just applying some sticky tape to some of the problems without really going into depth, because people know, EU leaders know, they have to deliver something, but that deal is going to probably be very fragile indeed.
Yeah, if there is a tendency to view these sort of serial crisis talks as just kicking the can down the road, the real worry has been that some of these big debt problems would shift to Italy, which is a much bigger economy than Greece. And indeed, Italy's been put under a lot of pressure leading up to this meeting. What kind of results are we going to get out of that? Is Italy going to deliver?
There is a promise on paper to deliver. Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian premier, has been up all night with EU officials and again this afternoon drafting this 14-page document promising reforms, crunch reforms, to get Italy's debt and financial problems under control. One key demand made by EU leaders to raise the retirement age to 67, he says he can now deliver on. So the noise is coming out from EU leaders are, well, this is pretty much as much as we could have dared to hope for. But of course, once again, the devil is in the detail. We know the huge disarray within the Italian government. We know that Silvio Berlusconi is going to really struggle to get his main coalition partners on board, and that his government has come perilously close to falling over these reforms, and it's not ruled out that it may yet fall. And so I think Italy is going to remain a very unpredictable factor in this Eurozone saga.
Vanessa Mock in Brussels there. Because German taxpayers of all political persuasions have become nervous about propping up indebted Eurozone countries, the German government began to consult legislators from all parties a bit more closely. There was a special session of parliament before Chancellor Angela Merkel left for Brussels, and all parties except the Left Party gave her their backing in efforts to shore up the euro. Hardy Grapner reports from Berlin.
Angela Merkel made yet another emphatic plea to Parliament to support her in her efforts to stabilise the euro and help bail out debt-stricken nations, Greece included. Her message, if the euro failed, Europe would fail too. But in the same breath, she also promised that the German taxpayer would not have to foot any bills in excess of the 211 billion euros that this country had already agreed to guarantee for within the rescue facility.
Deutschland übernimmt dabei Garantien von
Germany will guarantee a maximum of 211 billion euros, and this will not change, she said. We certainly have an interest in making the bailout fund as efficient as possible in the framework of binding EU contracts. You can rest assured that all schemes that would have presupposed a direct involvement of the ECB are off the table and will no longer be negotiated in Brussels. Opposition Social Democrat floor leader Frank-Walter Steinmeier said his party supported Merkel's negotiating mandate in Brussels, but he added that wasn't because of what he called the ruling government's inconsistent rescue endeavours, but because so much was at stake for the whole continent.
The European institutions
Of decisive importance appear to be helpless and are hardly visible nowadays, he said. People across the EU are concerned about their future well-being. The situation is dramatic indeed. The whole pan-European project is at stake. And what we are seeing in Brussels these days is not your regular round of high-level negotiations. It's rather an open-heart surgery, and all reasonable Europeans should keep their fingers crossed that the operation will be successful. Only the Left Party insisted that the options on the table right now were not suited to resolve the crisis in the long run, and their floor leader Gregor Gysi also said he was gravely concerned about the socially unbalanced way the crisis was being dealt with. I'm fed up with being told that those on welfare and low incomes have to foot the bill for the current crisis, he said. It's high time that those who have profited from massive speculation were finally told to contribute more. Secondly, you will only get on top of the crisis if you create public sector banks that will not dictate to the governments what to do. The parliamentary vote was accompanied by protests of anti-globalization campaigners near the Reichstag building. They unfolded huge banners demanding controls on the power of the big private banks. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Deutsche Welle.
Well, in Italy, the disasters are not just financial at the moment. They're natural, too. Rainstorms that have swept the country's north have left at least 9 people dead and 5 others missing. The rains have resulted in flash floods and mudslides that have wiped out entire villages. As Megan Williams reports, geologists as well as environmentalists say that the floods and the deaths could have been avoided if Italian laws were enforced.
It started off as a thunderstorm and within hours led to rivers of water rushing through small towns in northern Italy and pulling down whole hillsides of mud. The northern coastal town of Liguria has been hardest hit, with at least 2 of the 5 heritage Cinque Terre villages now isolated as a result of roads being washed away. Rivers of mud poured through the once picturesque villages of Vernazza and Monterosso. The mayor of Monterosso said the fishing village has been effectively wiped out. The mudslides have led to the shutting down of a major highway, with hundreds of cars and trucks being blocked. Soccer coach Nini Corda and his team are just some of the several thousand passengers who spent the night in their vehicles as rivers of mud ran past them nearby.
The water flipped over lots of cars and destroyed 2 whole towns. We were right nearby and saw it happen and people being killed. We were right next to a hill where a mudslide completely wiped out the highway.
The rainfall also affected the Tuscan town of Massa Carrara, famed for its white marble used by Michelangelo and other Renaissance artists. Experts say global climate change is provoking the downpours, but they also say deaths and billions of euros of damage could be avoided if Italy cracked down on overbuilding and disregard for Italian laws preventing construction on hillsides. Geologist Francesco Russo says things are getting worse and worse in Italy, the European country with the highest risk of landslides, with 10% of its territory in danger of shifting. Russo says there's no legal or financial motivation for prevention and much reward for responding to emergencies, where special committees of well-paid politicians are set up and private companies win huge contracts for repair and reconstruction. Maria Teresa Fagioli is the vice president of the Tuscan Geologists Association. She says even the huge amount spent repairing the damage only covers a fraction of the full costs of landslides in Italy.
In the past 20 years, 60 billion estimation of the damage, but we paid and we repair only for 22 billion.
So what happened to the other areas?
We haven't money, so they stay in this situation.
So towns stay abandoned, yes, people leave their homes, and it just stays that way.
Yes, they stay there, and we are searching for new money to repair this damage.
A discouraging scenario for the hundreds now left homeless by the latest downpours here. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
In France, another type of law flouting is coming under scrutiny. The parliament there is promising to get tough on social security cheats. It says it has research to show that up to 10% of public spending on health benefits is going into the pockets of undeserving fraudsters. And as John Lawrenson reports from Paris, it has a plan for a crackdown.
Greece may be the country where 5,000 civil servants were found to be drawing their pensions despite the fact that they had died. But as an all-party parliamentary committee has found, France is not far behind when it comes to taking the system for a ride. The head of the committee is ruling UMP party parliamentarian Dominique Thion.
Our conclusion was that fraud is costing us 20 billion euros. 17 billion euros of this is due to moonlighting, not declaring work in order to avoid paying employees and employers social security contributions, Thion told RTL Radio. This has become a French speciality, which I regret and which saddens me. The other 3 billion is people claiming benefit fraudulently, claiming benefits under a false identity, for example. That's a huge total, which comes close to the social security system deficit, which rose to 30 billion euros last year. But although this is a problem you find in many countries of the world, France is doubtless the worst organized to fight it. Thion says one reason is lack of political will to fight the problem. The last socialist government, Thion says, obliged officials tracking single-parent family benefit fraud to send a warning letter before investigating somebody suspected of not being a single parent at all, giving the person time to make their fraud look more convincing. But that period is over, says Health Minister Xavier Bertrand.
Certains diront qu'on en fait trop en matière de lutte contre les fraudes. Je pense au contraire qu'on n'en fait pas encore assez.
Some people will say we're doing too much to stop fraud, said Bertrand. I say we're not doing enough. When we checked sick leave, for example, we found that one claim out of six was fraudulent, and that enabled us to save at least 400 million euros. That money should be used to reduce our deficits and show greater solidarity with people who really deserve help.
Et avoir plus de solidarité avec ceux qui le méritent vraiment.
And to do this, the government says it wants to hit fraudsters hard. Valérie Pécresse is budget minister.
Nous proposerons la suspension immédiate de toutes les prestations.
We propose stopping immediately all social security benefit payments for people who use someone else's social security card, use a false social security number, receive benefit under a false identity, or who refuse to cooperate with investigators. And we mean all social security benefits.
Des prestations sociales.
That money the French budget cruelly needs to shore up confidence through the current debt crisis. But one possible hindrance to a clampdown is the way the French social security system is organised, because it is not run by the government, but jointly by the trade unions and the Employers' Federation. And they, anti-fraud campaigners say, do not have the same interest as the government in tackling the problem. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
Perspectives on the news from a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned into Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman, in Bonn. Tunisia's Islamist Ennahda Party has vowed to form a new government within a month, with early results giving it a commanding lead in the first free election to come out of this year's Arab Spring uprisings. Ennahda is short of an absolute majority, though, and any government would probably be made up of a coalition between secular and religious parties. As Eleanor Beardsley reports, that's what most Tunisians say they want.
Tunisians were in front of their television sets to watch the first official results from Sunday's election. As expected, the Islamist party, known as Ennahda, or Renaissance, has a significant lead, about 40% of the votes. Outside of Ennahda headquarters in Tunis, excited women ululated in joy at the party's strong showing in Tunisia's first democratic election. One of them was Mongia Khmeri, who spent 4 years in prison in the 1990s for belonging to Ennahda. Khmeri says she's glad the party can finally play a role in Tunisian life. Under dictator Zayn El Abidine Ben Ali, Ennahda was outlawed and many of its members jailed and even tortured. Many Tunisians say they trust Ennahda's leaders because of their resistance to the dictatorship, but others don't. Tunisia is the Arab world's most moderate and progressive country, where women have near equal rights to men. Many secular Tunisians fear Ennahda will try to roll back progress. When Ennahda's leader, Rachid Ghannouchi, went to vote on Sunday in an upscale neighborhood of Tunis, many young people yelled, "Dégage," or "Get out," the rallying cry of last January's revolution against the dictator. Ghannouchi says Ennahda wants to be a part of Tunisia's new democracy and has no plans to take away women's or anybody else's rights. Still, some Tunisians fear the party has a hidden agenda. One thing every Tunisian agrees upon is that Sunday's election was a stunning success. Lining up sometimes for hours, proud voters said they would respect the results no matter who won. Foreign observers like Jane Harman of the National Democratic Institute were impressed.
This election, to me, was hands down the best, the most promising election I have ever witnessed, including those I have seen in the United States.
Carts clatter through the cobbled lanes of Tunis's Kasbah. The medieval old town is a place of traditional values, but the merchants here are also pragmatic. They do business with the world and depend on the country's large tourism sector. Mohamed Begerbal says he voted Ennahda, but will be keeping a close eye on them.
If they break their promise to be moderate, we'll be back in the streets calling for them to get out. We don't want extremists. We want a modern Muslim country, kind of like Turkey.
Begerbal says Tunisia's democracy can serve as an example to countries like Libya, Egypt, and Syria. 25-year-old taxi driver Sami Draif is listening to one of Tunisia's popular rappers known as Balti. Tunisians, he says, like Balti, want to be both Muslim and modern, and they're sometimes conflicted, he says, as Balti raps on about going to the mosque one day and drinking wine the next. I don't really trust Ennahda, he says. I think they're going to try to change laws and make us young people do things we don't want to do. In an old house in Tunis lives Khaled Bey, the great-grandson of Tunisia's last monarch.
For the last 60 years, our leaders kept us divided. But we came together on January 14th. If we want to rebuild this country, we have to come together again. We have to listen to each other, respect each other, and share the same ideals.
Khaled Bey says he has no doubt Tunisians will do it. He says he saw the proof of that on election day. Eleanor Beardsley, Deutsche Welle Radio, Tunis.
A new book about Poland during the Second World War is breaking a taboo. It tells how some members of an ethnic group, normally perceived as victims of the Nazi occupation, were in fact Nazi collaborators. The ethnic group was the Gorale Highlanders. The Nazis referred to them as the Goralen folk. From Warsaw, Rafał Kipiszewski reports.
There's a dark secret hidden in Zakopane, Poland's prime winter skiing resort at the foot of the High Tatras. Zakopane is famous for the distinct culture of the Gorale Highlanders, whose dialect visitors from other parts of the country often find difficult to understand. It was this distinct identity which was exploited by the Nazis during the Second World War, when they tried to turn this remote part of occupied Poland into a separate entity. But unlike the rest of the country, where resistance to Nazi rule was strong, many Gorale Highlanders submitted to the Nazis. Some 27,000 signed the Goralen Folk List, and about 300 young local men joined the Waffen-SS to fight the Bolsheviks on the Eastern Front. In a recent TV documentary, this Zakopane man in his 90s, who was a wartime photographer at the time, describes how he witnessed the recruitment of the Goralen Folk Unit.
Przede wszystkim była propaganda ze strony Goralen Folk Organization.
It was all down to the propaganda of the Goralen Folk Organization, which spread fear among the local population, he explains. Some people I knew decided to join the Goralen Folk voluntarily, but things weren't always what they seemed. I saw a unit of young men being marched to the railway station in Zakopane to be taken to an SS training center. They had all been plied with alcohol, and many of them clearly didn't even realize what they were doing. Out of the 300 who signed up, most later deserted, and just a handful ended up in combat.
Zakopanem sądzeni byli przywódcy nowego germańskiego szczepu, Goralen Folku.
The last time the story of the Goralen Folk was mentioned publicly after the war was in this 1946 archive newsreel describing the trial of three of the organization's leaders who were handed down long prison sentences. Wacław Krzeptowski, the infamous Goralen Folk leader who didn't mind being photographed with Nazi officials, didn't make it to the trial. He had been tracked down and executed by the Polish resistance before the end of the war. But it wasn't until a series of recent media reports and the publication of a new book, Goralen Folk, The History of Betrayal, by historian Wojciech Szatkowski, that the 60-year-old taboo was finally broken. Joachim Ciecierski, a commentator of Polish-German relations, believes that it wasn't just an awkward topic for the people of the Highlands, but also for Poles in general. It contradicted existing stereotypes, suggesting the Polish people were solely the victims of Nazi ideology.
Polish people don't see themselves as collaborators with the Nazis, but the Goralen Folk were clearly an exception to this. After the war, nobody talked about it. If you asked anyone in the region, they immediately changed the subject, and quite frankly, although there has been a film about it and now a new book, it still touches a raw nerve. I think it's now important to talk about difficult topics because history isn't black and white.
Historians point out that the Goralen Folk concept didn't quite work out for the Nazis. Less than 20% of the locals actually signed up. But many believe that because the story of the collaborators was swept under the carpet for so long, the understanding of Nazi-occupied Poland was left incomplete. Rafał Kiepuszewski, Deutsche Welle Radio, Warsaw.
For more news and information, do visit our website, dw-world.de. There you can find podcasts of this and many other Deutsche Welle Radio programs. You're listening to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, we'll hear what kind of goals a group of agriculture policymakers and NGOs have been setting as they rethink how the world gets fed.
We won't need all these big seed companies who want to control everything. We won't need all these fertilizer companies who want to control also what's going on. But the farmers will be in charge in a system which will fulfill the needs of the people of the future.
We'll have that story in just a few minutes. First, though, Turkish tanks backed by helicopter gunships are continuing to enter northern Iraq. The initial reason given for the incursion was to track down Kurdish PKK rebels, who are being blamed for attacks on Turkish military bases last week, in which 24 government soldiers were killed. But now it seems that Ankara may be nurturing other ambitions. From Istanbul, Dorian Jones reports.
Turkey's military incursion into northern Iraq shows little signs of ending, with increasing numbers of tanks now entering the country. Already several thousand soldiers are deep in northern Iraq, seeking out the estimated 2,000 PKK rebels believed to be operating in the border region. Defense journalist Metehan Demir says the region has always been Turkey's biggest security problem.
The biggest problem for Turkey in fighting against terrorism is the infiltration of PKK terrorists from northern Iraq. Turkey has been trying to take necessary measures to stop the infiltration, but always failed.
Turkish forces have launched numerous incursions into Iraq against the PKK in the past 2 decades, but to little effect. But the large presence of armor this time, even if it's of little use in the rugged landscape, is seen as a sign that Ankara is seeking a permanent presence in the border region. Controlling mountain passes on the Iraqi side has long been seen as the only way of stopping PKK insurgents entering Turkey. And former Brigadier General Haldan Solmaztürk, a veteran of previous incursions, says Ankara would have only attempted such an operation providing it was sure it had U.S. support.
Now we understand that there is a common understanding reached by both sides, Turks and Americans, on which such operations could be conducted.
Washington has offered no criticism of Turkey's ongoing incursion, despite increasing concern from Baghdad and the local Iraqi Kurdish leadership. And indeed, Ankara's increasing assertiveness in Iraq may be even welcomed by Washington, according to political columnist Asla Aydintashbash. She says with U.S. troops quitting Iraq, Turkey can play a critical role for the U.S.
There's very much of a sentiment in this region that American influence is going down in the Middle East overall. You see this in Lebanon, definitely Iraq. There's a vacuum in this region. Turkey is trying to fill that vacuum. Iran is also trying to fill that vacuum right now.
This attempt is part of a general rethink of foreign policy priorities. Until recently, Turkey was working hard to improve relations with Iran, much to its Western allies' concern. But bilateral tensions have markedly cooled, especially after Ankara agreed to become part of a NATO anti-missile system, primarily aimed at Iran. Former Turkish diplomat Sinan Ulgen says that decision is a sign that Ankara is again closely realigning itself with its Western allies in the face of a revival in age-old tensions with its Iranian neighbor over Iraq.
This is a tension that is inherent in the relationship of Turkey with Iran. It is inherent because of the historical legacy, because of the influence that these countries are trying to have in the region, which pit one against the other.
That competition can only intensify as U.S. troops withdraw from Iraq by the end of the year. Fears are growing in the U.S. that Iraq could become an Iranian satellite. Observers say Turkey may be Washington's best chance of avoiding that scenario. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
As we just heard, Ankara's participation in the U.S.-led missile shield project has had a big effect on Turkey's relations in the region and with Washington. The same could be said for the Czech Republic, where a prior proposed version of the shield was to be located. Its Prime Minister Petr Nečas is currently on his way to Washington, where he'll be received at the White House by President Obama. It's a rare accolade for the prime minister of a small country in faraway Central Europe, but there's good reason for it. Not only is the Czech Republic a strong ally in the NATO operation in Afghanistan, but an American firm is bidding to build two reactors at the Czech Temelín nuclear power plant. Rob Cameron has more.
A rapturous welcome for Barack Obama on his inaugural visit to Prague as president in April 2009, where he outlined a vision of a world without nuclear weapons. President Obama heaped praise on the city and the Czech nation in their centuries-long struggle for freedom from oppression.
For over 1,000 years, Prague has set itself apart from any other city in any other place. You've known war and peace. You've seen empires rise and fall. You've led revolutions in the arts and science, in politics and in poetry. Through it all, the people of Prague have insisted on pursuing their own path and defining their own destiny. And this city, this golden city, which is both ancient and youthful, stands as a living monument to your unconquerable spirit.
But it was President Obama, too, who later that year picked up the telephone and called acting Prime Minister Jan Fischer to tell him that the United States had decided to abandon a plan to build a radar base on Czech soil as part of its missile defense shield. The decision had been long expected. Obama was always against the Bush administration's plan, and it was clear he needed to drop it to improve relations with Russia. But it still caused some anger amongst some Czechs who saw it as evidence that Washington was abandoning Central Europe. Today, however, that relationship rests on economic, not strategic priorities. In a few days' time, the Czech government will announce the biggest public tender in its history, building a third and fourth reactor at the Temelín nuclear power plant. It'll be a multi-billion dollar project, a massive endeavour and one of the few active nuclear tenders anywhere in the world. Three firms are in the bidding: France's Areva, a Russian-Czech consortium led by Atomstroy Export, and Westinghouse, the US firm which fitted much of the operating and safety technology at Temelín's reactors number 1 and 2. Heavy US lobbying has therefore opened the doors to the White House for Mr. Nečas, although the Czechs are certainly in no hurry to pick a winner, as I found out from the government's plenipotentiary for completion of Temelín, Václav Bartuška.
But we keep telling everybody, and quite openly, that the decision in 2013 can also be not to build, if the price is too high, or if simply none of the three will persuade us that they are able to build on time, on schedule, on budget. Now, I went through all the power stations being built at the moment by all three bidders in all countries of the world, and I have not seen a single one which would run full on the schedule. So none of the three persuaded me at the moment, really, up until now, that they can build on time, on budget.
There is one final note of interest in this trip to the White House. President Obama has yet to extend an invitation to the Czech president, Václav Klaus. His outspoken views on global warming, human rights activism, and US economic policy have sometimes put him at odds with the current American administration. And one wonders whether Mr. Klaus will be invited to Washington before his presidential term expires in 2013. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague.
Around the world, around the clock, news and information from the heart of Europe. On Deutsche Welle Television, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. You're listening to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Envoys from the Middle East Quartet held talks on Wednesday with Israeli and Palestinian negotiators to try and find a way to restart stalled peace talks. However, the chances of breaking the deadlock, which has gripped the negotiations for more than a year, still appear remote. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is so angry with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's stance toward the peace talks that she's holding back a Dolphin submarine that Germany was to supply to Israel. Iris Meckler in Jerusalem has the story.
The day the quartet had designated to restart stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks began with a disagreement between Israel and one of her staunchest allies, Germany. According to a report in Israel's leading newspaper, a German deal to supply Israel with a Dolphin-class submarine is now at risk. The paper reports that German Chancellor Angela Merkel is frustrated with Israel's continued building in the West Bank, and particularly 1,400 new Jewish homes to be built in East Jerusalem and approved just earlier this week. Israel's hardline foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, responded Wednesday morning. He says he neither confirms nor denies the conflict with Germany, but says any German anger against Israel is not justified. Lieberman defends Israel's right to continue to build Jewish homes in the West Bank, and particularly Jerusalem. He blames Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas for demanding a freeze on building as a precondition for talks. Abbas negotiated with former Israeli prime ministers, with Ariel Sharon and with Ehud Olmert, and never made such a demand, says Lieberman. Abbas only made this demand for the first time once our government came to power. Lieberman went on to criticise Abbas, the moderate Palestinian leader who's renounced violence against Israel, and who'll be conducting peace talks with Israel if the international initiative succeeds. I think Abbas is one of the biggest obstacles to peace today. He's not trustworthy, says Lieberman. During the war with Hamas in Gaza in 2009, he contacted us and asked us to continue the war and to finish off the Hamas leadership. And then after the war, he took us to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. The Palestinian Authority's chief negotiator, Saeb Erekat, responded immediately, accusing Israel's foreign minister of incitement and endangering President Abbas's life.
I think his incitement is tantamount to assassination and killing Abu Mazen. I mean, such mafia politicians, mafia-style politicians like Lieberman, I don't think that they belong to the 21st century politics.
Lieberman defends his undiplomatic style and prides himself on saying publicly what others only whisper privately. He's expressing the frustration of the right wing in Israel that Abbas has struck out on an independent path towards Palestinian statehood, pursuing various bids for recognition at the United Nations. Israel's president, Shimon Peres, was quick to step in. He countered the foreign minister's statements, describing Abbas as a serious leader and a partner for peace. But each side has a precondition which, even if it's downgraded to a demand, will be difficult for the other to meet. The Palestinians want a freeze on Israeli construction in Jewish settlements. And Israelis want a recognition of Israel as a Jewish state, as well as suspension of the Palestinians' UN bid while talks proceed. For these reasons, any negotiations are likely to quickly become mired in disagreements and may not lead where the international community hopes. Iris Mackler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Jerusalem.
Perspectives on the news, a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio from Bonn, Germany.
The global population is set to reach 7 billion in just a few days' time. According to the United Nations, the world's 7 billionth baby will be born on Sunday, October 31st. This represents a huge leap. In 1959, in living memory for some people, the global population was just 3 billion. As Imogen Folks reports from Geneva, a new UN report suggests that our response to this challenge will determine whether our future is healthy and sustainable or marked by environmental decline and economic downturn.
It took hundreds of thousands of years for the world population to hit 1 billion. In comparison, it took only 123 more years to reach 2 billion, and merely 33 years to hit 3 billion.
These are the statistics, but should we be worried by them?
Every second, an average of 4.2 people are born and 1.8 people die.
In fact, 7 billion people on the planet can be something to celebrate, the UN believes. Many people around the world are living longer. Children are much less likely to die in infancy. but not everyone has benefited from this higher quality of life. And in its report, the UN warns that unless we manage resources fairly, the world's 7 billion people, set to rise to 10 billion by the end of the century, will be divided by inequalities over access to food, water, housing, and work. So is it resources and the way we use them that we need to fret about, rather than numbers of people? British environmentalist and author of the book Peoplequake, Fred Pearce, believes so.
If you take the global average, women today are having 2.5 children, which is half as many as their mothers had. So around the world, families are getting smaller. So we're defusing the population bomb. We are not, however, defusing what I would call the consumption bomb. And it seems to me that if you look at the global use of resources and climate change and all these really big issues, then it is the consumption bomb that is sending us in the wrong direction.
But the UN State of the World's Population report warns it's not quite as simple as that. Women in rich countries are having so few children, the population there is stagnating, sometimes even falling. In poor countries, women continue to have many children. That's why, says population specialist Professor Hans Rosling, the world's 2 billion poorest, whose daily struggle is for food, are set to increase their numbers rapidly.
What about the poorest 2 billion? Well, here population comes in. Here population is growing. So these 2 billion will, in the next decades, increase to 3 billion, and then will thereafter increase to 4 billion. But if, and only if, they get out of poverty, they get education, they get improved child survival, they can buy a bicycle and a cell phone and come here, then population growth will stop up there in 2050.
But lifting the world's poorest out of poverty will increase consumption of resources. That's why the UN has outlined several key challenges which must be faced if population is to grow in a sustainable way. Predicted water shortages need to be addressed now, and as increasing numbers of people live in cities, better urban planning is essential too. Investment in work opportunities for the young and care for the growing numbers of elderly will be crucial, the UN report says, and another key factor will be family planning. Today, the UN points out, 215 million women around the world have no access to family planning advice. Ensuring a good future for the global population will, the UN says, mean ensuring that every new child joining it is a planned and wanted child. Imogen Folks, Deutsche Welle Radio, Geneva.
So we've just about got to 7 billion people on our planet. And if you weren't aware, about a billion at any given time don't get enough to eat. Supporters of technology-driven agricultural practices say that they can help with that. Their critics, however, claim the current reliance on fossil fuel-based fertilizers is among the biggest threats to the environment, meaning that if we don't develop more sustainable approaches, the planet will become even less able to feed its growing population. And so worldwide, people are calling for more sustainable food cultivation practices. Now politicians are starting to pay attention to the problem. Nina Haza has this report.
There are now 7 billion of us living on the planet, and we all need to eat. Some say that modern technology will help us find more effective ways of planting and help feed our growing population. But Benedikt Herrlin from the German agricultural lobby organisation ZSL believes this is the wrong way of thinking. For years, he's warned that industrial agricultural technology will not solve the problem of hunger. Instead, it will make the situation worse.
It's obvious that the food model we have lived by in the industrialized world so far is making us fat. The number of obese people is higher than the number of malnourished. Obesity is one of the biggest health issues we have in industrialized countries, and we spend large amounts of money on it. So that can't be the model we use to solve the problem of hunger.
Herrlin was on the board of the IAASTD when it launched in 2008. IAASTD stands for International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science and Technology for Development. It's a report that caused quite a stir 3 years ago. It was initiated by the World Bank, World Health Organization and UN Food Organization, FAO, and it dealt a blow to industrial agriculture as we know it. The report suggested that eco-friendly agricultural practices and small-scale farmers need much more support, and it issued a stern warning on genetic engineering, as well as agricultural chemicals and the patenting of seeds. Many members of the IASTD were outraged and left the working groups. Among them, chemical and seed processing giants like Monsanto, Syngenta and BASF. Some countries made it clear they did not agree with some of the report's conclusions. Critics also alleged that the report was influenced by, quote, certain ideologies. 3 years later, things are different. Some of the report's conclusions have been recognized as fact by politicians worldwide, according to Tobias Reichert. He's a consultant for World Trade and Food with the NGO German Watch. He's also an expert on European agricultural politics.
When you look at the debate going on in the European Commission about how to reform European agricultural policy after 2013, you can see there's an increasing willingness to stress the eco-friendly aspects of agriculture. Many also think this should be a deciding factor in determining what receives major subsidies, which are still being paid to European farmers.
The European Union has been subsidizing local agriculture extensively, and Reichert says that has a detrimental impact on the environment in Europe, because much of the subsidies go to industrial agriculture. In addition, these subsidies also lead to an uneven distribution of food on a global scale.
There are two reasons why industrial agriculture, especially in Europe, has a negative effect on the global food situation. When you look at animal farming in particular, industrialization in the EU has led to the production of far too many animal products. And that means that A, we've developed bad nutritional habits in Europe, and B, there's too much of it available and we can't even consume all of it here in the EU.
Of course, the products that are not being eaten by Europeans have to go somewhere. So they're exported to other industrialized countries, but also to emerging economies and developing nations. But it's impossible for farmers there to compete with the subsidized prices the EU goods sell for. The result? Exports from industrialized countries are destroying local agriculture, be it in Russia, Asia or Africa. In addition, jobs are lost and food insecurity increases in rural areas where poverty rates are highest. The system is also bad for the environment. Forest land is cleared for animal feed and ethanol crops because the meat and dairy industries need feed for their livestock and because demand for biofuels is on the rise. That means soil that could be used to plant crops for our food are lost, says Todro Menza from the organization Amis de la Terre in Togo.
My country, one organization from England, a businessman, come to land 40 million hectares to plant jatropha. No, the land is for food, for agriculture. He takes to make jatropha while to exportation to Europe for biofuel. No, no, and no.
The 2008 report on agricultural practices recommends that food be produced where it's needed, in a sustainable and eco-friendly way. Hans Herren is the president of the Millennium Institute and was vice president of the 2008 IAASTD. He's worked in developing countries for years and knows that rethinking agriculture will substantially challenge the current system.
This will require a totally different support system behind it. We won't need all these big seed companies who want to control everything. We won't need all these fertilizer companies who want to control also what's going on. But the farmers will be in charge in a system which is regenerative, which is sustainable, which will fulfill the needs of the people of the future.
And that, he says, would allow us to provide more and higher quality food to a growing world population and do it in an environmentally friendly way. Nina Hase, Deutsche Welle Radio.
John Colley is an artist traveling by foot throughout Europe. He lives from the money that he raises by selling his art, and anything left over he gives away to charity. It's a life almost devoid of modern technology, just sketches, paintings, and canvas. No wonder it was so hard tracking him down. But our reporter Andre Leslie managed to find him in Cologne, at work.
Monday morning in front of the Cologne Cathedral. The square is busy with people dashing to work. In the middle of it all is an unshaven man making sketches on a large piece of paper. His boots are muddy and scuffed, and his T-shirt is covered in old sweat stains. Meet John Colley, the travelling artist from Birmingham. Bent over his large sheet of paper, with his eyes occasionally raised to focus on the cathedral, Colley seems oblivious to the passers-by and tourists moving past him. But it's apparent that something is annoying him slightly.
Today the wind conditions are very difficult. It's very blustery, and that it doesn't just blow the paper around, it blows into your face, blowing dust into your eyes when you're trying to see what you're doing. So, not pleasant today, but for me it still beats sitting in an office working at a computer.
In the last 7 months, Colley has journeyed some 2,700 kilometres across Europe from his adopted homeland, Spain, most of it on foot. His aim was to get to Russia, but so far he's only made it to Berlin. He sketched in Nice, in Montpellier, Vienna, Bratislava, and now Cologne. Today, as is often the case, he is surrounded by people watching him at work.
It's a very complicated sketch, complicated building. Anyone who's seen the cathedral in Cologne will know just how ornate it is. It's a very Gothic piece that's been built over centuries and centuries. So I'm starting finding a middle point, and then that gives me a reference point, I guess. It's like building a jigsaw. You look for the pieces and put them in place little by little.
John Colley is what modern sociologists would call a downshifter. He's left the rat race for a new life with less stress. The 44-year-old worked up until 2005 in the advertising business in London. He did long hours, had a flashy apartment, and was earning well. But at some stage, he couldn't go on, he says. He decided to move to Andalusia in Spain and started his life as an itinerant artist. That's what he now calls himself. Colley lives from the sales of the art he paints on the streets. He retains only the funds which he needs to live, anything extra he gives to charity. In the last 3 years, he's collected some 100,000 euros for good causes, he says. The donations generally go to local organisations in the area that he's passing through.
People are interested in what I'm doing, and once they know what I'm doing, they might just leave a coin on the sketch. Perhaps 80% of the work I sell goes to people locally. And maybe that's because the work I do is so big, so it's a problem for tourists to take home.
Colley's mother was an art teacher, but he says he's pretty much taught himself to paint and sketch in the last 6 years. His favourite medium is sketching, since pens and pencils are easier to transport than paints. His inspiration comes from life's experiences, he says, although he admits to particularly enjoying his stop in Arles, in southern France, depicting the scenes that Vincent van Gogh also painted. The sale of today's piece, a 1 metre by 2 metre sketch of the west side of the cathedral, should cover his accommodation costs comfortably. Colley is pretty relaxed about getting the money in.
I will finish in 2.5-3 hours, but I've practiced. I do this every day, so obviously the more you do it, the faster you get and more confident.
The artist finishes his European trip this month. Cologne is actually on the way back home to Spain. In the cold months of the year, you can barely earn a thing doing street art, he says. But next spring, John Colley plans on setting off again. And this time, he wants to get as far as Estonia. Andre Leslie, Deutsche Welle Radio, Cologne.
That's all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you join us again tomorrow. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.